So where were we? We were just in the midst, or almost finished with defining the gradient of a scalar field, and then also using it to relate the coordinate basis for the tangent space to the corresponding dual basis for the cotangent space, in other words, for covectors. So I'll just remind you where we were. We had the gradient of some scalar field, F was some map, some scalar field on space-time. In other words, it's a map of M into R. And I'll define this to be, just for shorthand, writing the formulas, I'll just call this omega, or which you could also, using the abstract index notation, you would decorate it with this this covariant lowercase a, in this case, but mainly a covariant index. And the definition of the gradient was, now I'm using this sort of infinitesimal notation, that if we apply it to an infinitesimal displacement in the manifold, that's a vector, if we take the inner product, or the contraction of that vector with the gradient covector, we get the change in the value of the function as you move from the one point to the other. So here's a point P in the manifold. Here's sort of P plus DP. Here's F of P. Here's F of P plus DP. Then df, of course, I just mean f of p plus dp minus f of p. Right? As usual, if you like, you can divide through by some d lambda and make it all in terms of curves, not have to talk about infinitesimals. And then the picture of the gradient is then this. Just as the picture of dp is this vector, the picture of the gradient of a function, if this is these are the lines of constant functions, so this is like f equals 0, f equals 1, f equals 2, really I want, a more fine-grained thing, like f equals epsilon, f equals 2 epsilon, and so on. And then you just isolate a sort of infinitesimal portion of this, and you just see a series of straight lines, if you make this box small enough, at a evenly spaced straight lines, and those, if I take, remember, then that's the picture of a covector. So if I isolate the one, say I want the value of the covector at this point P, I take that one and this one, and I put, say, a little minus and a plus to show which way it's going, that's the picture of the covector, right? So that's the geometrical. It's a geometrical interpretation of what's going on. Remember, you could think of this like a topographical map, and these are the lines of different altitude, or they're the lines of different temperature in a kind of weather map. And then how close their space shows how rapidly the temperature is changing, and the way they're oriented shows in which direction it's changing most rapidly. Although that to say that you really need a metric, but anyway, the way that they're oriented shows you the direction in which it's changing and the direction in which it's not changing, and so on. Also, then maybe just to translate into the other language that we might have used before. So now let's consider this dp as part of a curve. So imagine there's some curve in the manifold, gamma. So I'll now think that p is equal to gamma of lambda. I'll assume that gamma of 0 is equal to, say, p naught. And the vector v is then, using our notation, dp d lambda, which is d gamma of lambda d lambda at lambda equals 0, So if you want, you can write a somewhat peculiar looking equation, but it conforms to the definitions we made, which is that gamma is an element of V, which is an element of the tangent space to M at P naught. It looks funny, not because of this, of course, but because of this. What do I mean by gamma as an element of V? Well, it's just going back to the definition that we gave of V as an equivalence class of curves. So this just means gamma is one of the curves that belongs to the equivalence class. That's V. Geometrically, the real geometrical pictorial meaning is that V is the tangent vector to the curve gamma at lambda equals zero. In that case, we would write the same equation here that we wrote. We would, in terms of V and this omega, which is the name I gave to the gradient, that would just be that's equal to d by d lambda of F circle gamma of lambda at lambda equals zero. Okay, so it's just the rate of change. So what we're saying is when you apply the gradient of F to a vector, what you get is the rate of change of F along the curve whose tangent is that vector. Okay? That was the definition. And then there was the question, is this definition, is this function of V linear? Of course, if it's not linear, then this still defines something, but it can't be regarded as a covector, because a covector has to be a linear map of the vectors into the scalars. So if it is, then it's valid to think of this omega, which is the gradient of F at P naught, let's say, or at P. It's valid to think of that as being in the what's called the cotangent space, this dual space to the tangent space. So let me prove that. I'll do the proof in infinitesimal form, since it looks a little simpler. It's always the same story with these things. We'll just use the equivalence principle, if you like, that is the existence of this chart, to transform the question into a question in a vector space. And we'll also use the following equation, which I either wrote or wrote something closely equivalent to before, which is the definition of this this thing that's effectively the derivative of the chart map. It wants to be the derivative of the chart map. C, so this that C star, I've left out the reference to where it's evaluated, but it has to be evaluated also at the right place, wherever, at P, basically. So when we apply that to the infinitesimal displacement, we get the corresponding infinitesimal displacement mapped over into V sub C, the chart map, the space into which C goes. Okay, so using that, we can just unpack this left-hand side and show that, in fact, this is just, if we hold fixed F, then this is just some function of dP. We want to show that function is linear. And that just comes from basically using the definitions and this trick. So now I'll be careful with the place which I want to evaluate it, which I'll call P naught, using those definitions that are covered up for the moment. So that was by definition df, which if I write it out more fully, is df of P. Now I transfer it to the chart. What does that mean? I insert the identity operator, I think of it as F circle C inverse circle C, which is just the identity applied to P, okay, then just regrouping, that's the same thing as, so I'll regroup them as just, instead of grouping C inverse with C, I'll group it with F, and then I'll put C of P over here. So this is the map F circle C inverse applied to C of P. Now we use, what do we do? Let me see if I can get. Hi, the speaker is echoing.
Oh, sorry.
The little speaker in the room.
There you go. You should be fine.
Okay. Okay. Hello, hello? Yeah, okay, no echo. Then using the definition of the derivative, that's just equal to F circle C inverse. This F circle C inverse is really just the function F, the scalar field transferred to the chart, to the vector space that defines the chart. So it's the derivative of that. This is just the thing that we just talked about before. So, evaluated at where C of P naught, which I took to be zero, will take to be zero, and then you apply that to the change in C of P. I'll take C of P naught to be zero. And so then I can write this as equal to F circle C inverse prime, the derivative at zero now, a circle. So this is just applying it to, now I'm using this relation here, D of C of P is just equal to C star, lower star, applied to DP, okay, where this C star is actually at the map belonging to the point P naught. So, regarding both sides as a function or an operator acting on DP, you see what it is. It says that the implication or the conclusion from all this, I guess I can put it here, is that, let me put it here, it'll get covered up in a second, that says, because DP was arbitrary, it says that the gradient of F, which I also called omega, evaluated at P naught, is equal to F circle C inverse, evaluated at zero prime, circle C star, evaluated at P naught. But this is the composition of two linear functions, and so therefore, this is linear by definition, if you will, and this one is linear by the definition, by the meaning. If we assume that there's a, if we assume that F is differentiable, then this is exists, and it's also by definition linear. This is a circle here. So the gradient is the composition of two linear functions, therefore it's linear, which is what we needed to show. Okay? Any questions? So let me restate the main idea now, which is, I'll just leave the, go on to the next. Which I said is that, I said in words before, that contracting the gradient of a function with a vector gives the rate of change of F along V. So in words, that's all that's going on. And the picture is up there. So if I use the same picture, this is P, this is Q, then I think of them as very close together, then all I'm saying is that Q minus P dotted into the gradient, that is the inner product, sometimes represented as dot, sometimes as by parentheses, that's equal to F of Q minus F of P. Okay. Now this, okay, so this makes something obvious, which I think, which I proved the time before in an unnecessarily complicated way, basically a way that was reproving some things that we had already done that didn't really need to be reproved. So let me state it a little more simply. This makes it completely obvious that the components of the gradient of F, which I called omega, are omega, so these are the coordinate components in a coordinate basis, are df dx alpha. We proved this before, but if you just take this to heart, then it becomes completely obvious. So here's the proof, here's the argument for it. So why is that? Well, what was the alpha's component? The alpha's, or let's draw a little picture to have in mind. So here's a sort of the x alpha direction. Here's some sort of, okay. So the alpha's coordinate basis, the alpha's basis vector in the coordinate basis, where is it? If we think P is here, that's the vector that points along the it goes from 0 to 1 basically along the alpha's direction, right? So this is this yellow vector that I've drawn here. That's what I've called E alpha A, the basis vector. The first basis vector. Okay. So once you have that, then what is omega alpha? Omega alpha, remember, is just the contraction of omega the contraction of omega with that basis vector, with the alpha's basis vector, which we can write like this. But that's just EA alpha. Omega was just the gradient of F. And we just said that, I don't even know that I needed to write omega here, but anyway, I guess it's for the purpose of this notation. So we just said that the meaning of this is the rate of change of F, here it is, the rate of change along this vector, but the rate of change of some function f along the alpha's basis vector, that's just by definition what we mean by the partial derivative or the directional derivative of f along with respect to the alpha's coordinate, right? These are just by definition the same thing. So it shows, so that's sort of the more self-evident argument for why it's true. So notice here also a consistency, that the notation is consistent in a certain sense. So when I write something like this, this is a concrete index. We could think of it two ways. We could think of it, which is what we've just done, take the gradient of F and take its alpha's component. But this is also a very common notation, to just a shorthand to mean partial f, partial x alpha, right? If this equality was not true, then there would be a disaster, a notational disaster. But we just saw that it is true, of course, not by accident. And so you don't have to worry. Do you mean this the alpha's component of the gradient, Or do you mean, which is a covector, or do you just mean the partial derivative of f in the alpha's direction? It doesn't matter, because they're both equal. When you write the abstract index like this, then you mean, for sure, you mean the gradient. You mean a certain covector. You don't mean a set of numbers. But when you write it like this, it's a set of numbers, and you can think of those numbers in two ways, which are fortunately equivalent to each other. Okay, now that we've defined gradient, which is, of course, important in itself, we can also write a formula for the dual basis in a coordinate chart. So remember, we already defined the basis corresponding to the coordinate chart, which is pictured here. Let me now think about the dual basis. In order to do that, since we're still being careful, we think of this map that takes the point in the manifold to its coordinates in the coordinate chart. And so I'm going to regard that as the result of applying four distinct functions to P. The four coordinates, these are the four scalar fields that represent the coordinates. So like in this picture here, and that picture there, I guess that's the only one we have, that picture. So this is a point in R4 now. Then I claim that, this is another very simple to prove fact, I claim that the alpha's co-basis vector, which I can represent this, is just given by the gradient of the alpha's coordinate function. So this is not a definition, this is a theorem, although you'll see it's a very trivial theorem. So notice again that the indices are in the right places. So this is a covariant index. This, of course, has to be a covariant index. And the convention I made, we write both of these are not tensor indices, but they're both written them as raised indices. So how do we prove this? So here's, again, I put proof because it's it's all basically just notation again. Oops, I don't want to prove this. Why was I writing that? Didn't make sense. So what does it mean to say that? I've defined the basis vector here. We defined it earlier, and now I've claimed that this gives the dual basis vector. So what does it mean to say that it gives the dual basis? It means that the dual basis is the thing which, when contracted with the basis, gives Kronecker delta. In other words, when you contract corresponding basis and dual basis vectors, you get one, and when you contract off diagonal ones that don't match, you get zero. So that's all we have to prove. So the question we need to evaluate, given this definition of the this ansatz that we've made for the dual basis vector, we have to check that it works. That is, we have to check that this thing is 1 when alpha equals beta and 0 otherwise. But what is this? We just said that that should be the co-basis, the gradient of the alpha's coordinate function. And we want to apply that to EA beta. But what is that? That's contracting some vector. I mean, we just saw before with the gradient of some function, which happens to be the coordinate function. So it's the rate of change of that. So it's just the partial derivative of, as we wrote it, partial derivative in the beta direction of x alpha, right? Which, or in another notation, is just partial x alpha over partial x beta, and of course, that's equal to delta alpha beta. So there's nothing, so it's a kind of triviality. Okay, so that's all. So we've covered, we're sort of working on components of tensors now, specials, in which we saw you get by introducing a basis. Once you have a basis, you get components of tensors. So given a tensor on the manifold or a tensor field, you can choose any basis you like, really, for the tangent space, and that'll give you components. But there's a special set of bases that are particularly useful and common, which are the so-called coordinate bases, which came in the way we reviewed here from a coordinate chart. That is a chart that goes into R4. Given such a chart, you get a natural basis, and when you take, and then the basis and dual basis are those that we've just defined. Okay, so is there any, that's all that I'm going to say, almost all that I'm going to say about bases, except we'll talk a little bit about orthonormal bases in a second. First, I want to just define the metric tensor. So is there any questions on this so far? Okay, so we've already seen the metric and its components, and although we didn't prove, or I can't remember if we did or not, show that they were actually the components of some tensor. I think I just told you that. So now that we have all the machinery, we can talk about tensors. We can more properly introduce the metric tensor, GAB. Okay, so this is, remember, the indices show you where it lives, and it lives in T at the point P. It lives in the tensor product of those two. Vector spaces. It's, so when we write the indices like that, anyway. So where does this metric tensor come from? Well, again, it's basically coming just from the equivalence principle, which is telling you that that the tangent space to a point on the manifold has the same geometry as the space-time of special relativity. In other words, it's telling you that in an infinitesimal neighborhood of a point, we just see special relativity. So the claim is that TPM, this is the motivation for introducing the metric tensor. It has the geometry of Minkowski space. That's sort of the equivalence. It's an aspect of the equivalence principle. In any case, we assume it. Once we assume that, that means, well, what does it mean to have the geometry of Minkowski space? Well, if you think about it, I'm not sure how it was presented to you, but if it was presented to you in a certain way, you would see that all it means is that we can form inner products of vectors in Minkowski space. Just like in Euclidean space, you can form inner products of vectors using the Euclidean metric. So it's just, you know, the length of 1 times the length of 2 times the cosine of theta between them is their inner product. Once you know that inner product, you know everything about the geometry of Euclidean space. And by the same token, once you know the inner product between two Lorentzian vectors, you know everything about the geometry of Minkowski space. Of course, this inner product is now an inner product. It's not the one I was talking about before, which was always given to you. It has nothing to do with geometry as such, just between a vector and a covector. That's always defined just by the meaning of those concepts. But to take an inner product between a vector and another vector is something that you can't necessarily do. But this metric lets us do it. It's the thing, it is exactly the thing that lets you do it. So now we can form inner products of, so we can take two vectors, which are in this tangent space, and then we can form their inner product, which I can call V, and that's the inner product. Of the two vectors. Therefore, furthermore, and so everything I'm saying is just something that you already know from special relativity. Furthermore, it's bilinear, and so it actually gives you a map of, just for shorthand, I'm going to write V now as we've been doing for T, for the tangent space of the manifold. So this gives you a map of V cross V into the scalars. So therefore, it belongs to there's something to actually be checked here, but the fact that this is bilinear, it's linear in each argument. In other words, the fact, just what you know, that U plus U1 plus U2 dot V is equal to U1 dot V plus U2 dot V, right? That's the linearity. That fact means that this is well defined on any tensor, which you can easily check. Or if you knew the universal mapping property, you wouldn't even have to check it. But we hadn't discussed that explicitly. So that tells you that it's in the dual space to this tensor space. And we saw before that that's really this. So just these are all, when you use the notation that is normally used, these all are sort of really nitpicking points. But it's telling that you can represent this by a covariant tensor with two indices. Also, of course, as the special case of inner product of two vectors, if we take an inner product of two infinitesimal of an infinitesimal displacement with itself, then we get by definition that, which I've now written as dp gab dpa dpb. So that's the line element, of course, as it's called. And we saw it before, but we saw it in components. So how does it look in components? Well, in components, we now saw, you know, we know the rules for contraction and so on. So in components, we just replace all these with numerical indices, alpha, beta, dp, alpha, dp, beta, and if we are in a coordinate chart, then, as we saw, so what do I mean by the alpha's component of dp, of course, is by definition just the change d of the x coordinate of the alpha's coordinate along that infinitesimal displacement. So we can replace this by, which we normally just write as dx alpha. Right. Don't normally bother with these parentheses. So we can, in this we can substitute dx, and then you see that it's the formula we had before. So that makes the connection with the formula for the line. We saw the formula we had for the line element before is just this definition written out in the coordinate chart. So the notation, so we also have the ds squared is equal to this matrix dotted into these two column vectors. So our notation is consistent. When we wrote this before, although I don't think I used the parentheses when we wrote that before, again, we can read it in two ways. We can read it, but now we're able to read it. Before it was just some formula, now we can read it as the contraction expressed in components of GAB with DP in itself. And once we have the tensor, once we have the tensor GAB, Now we'll be able to, we'll be able to raise and lower indices, what's called raise and lower indices. So remember what, this again is all sort of natural, just straightforward. We said that the metric tensor is that thing which allows you to take an inner product of two vectors, which you couldn't do. Before, we could only take the inner product of a vector and a covector. So this, to say that we can, if we say that we can take the inner product of two vectors, that really means that we can just turn one of the vectors into a covector and then use the old inner product. So another way of saying what a metric is it's a way of converting between vectors and covectors. And this is the definition. This is the definition that we use, which again is all familiar. It's the only thing that might be slightly different is I'm using abstract indices. This is now contraction of two tensors. But so this, of course, is the, it's called the inverse metric. And it's defined by this equation. So you might ask, well, how do you know that there is such a metric and so on? Well, that's all just, remember, we're really just doing special relativity in the tangent space. So again, that's what guarantees it from a physical point of view. Mathematically, we just say we assume that the metric, we assume that GAB exists. In fact, of course, we've actually assumed more. We've actually assumed that this thing has a certain signature, the Lorentzian signature, and that guarantees that its inverse exists. In other words, we've assumed that you can find some basis in which it just looks like minus, plus, plus, plus. And so that follows from the fact that the signature of the metric, which we haven't actually bothered to define formally, is this. But it can be defined maybe not in the most intrinsic way, but it can be defined by what I just said, that there exists some basis, which is an orthonormal basis for it, with the diagonal being this minus one plus one plus one plus one. So notice now one last consistency in the notation. We've seen several. The last consistency of the notation, I didn't say this, but I think it's completely familiar, that we use these things now to raise and lower indices. So if we're given a tensor that looks like TAB, for example, then by say lowering B, we can make it look like this. What does that mean? That means TA, here I'll use this. TAB, GBB, right? Where you're contracting this. If you don't like this, think of this, one of these B's as being a C. So you just by appropriate contractions with either the metric or the inverse metric, you can raise and lower the indices. That's the usual story. But notice now that once we do this, there's now another question of consistency. This is actually, in the case of spinner spaces, this causes a sign headache. But here, it doesn't cause a sign headache, fortunately. And that is that I could now read GAB in two ways. I can read it according to its original definition, which is given here. Or I could say, well, here I have the metric. It's just a tensor. Any tensor, I can raise and lower its indices. What if I raise the indices on this? What do I get? If I didn't get GAB, then there would be, again, a notational catastrophe. But as you can trivially check, you do get GAB. So raising the indices on the lowered form of the metric tensor gives the raised form, its inverse. So I've written that as GAB equals GAB. So one doesn't have to worry. Where did I put all this? Any questions on that? Yeah. Okay, so Lorentzian signature means that I can find some basis in which G alpha beta takes the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and all zeros here, right? Well, this is clearly an invertible matrix. So if then G alpha beta will be actually the same matrix, right? So if I take the matrix product of this with itself, I get 1. So it means that in this basis, in the corresponding dual basis, I can explicitly exhibit the inverse. So the statement is that if the signature is this, that implies that G is invertible. That's all.
If the signature
was different, then it really depends if there's a zero in the signature. If there's a zero anywhere in the signature, then it's not invertible. And if there's not, so all of these, this is the familiar one, although it would be four-dimensional Euclidean space, that would also be invertible. This one, which as far as I know has almost never arisen in physics, but maybe it, but some relative of it has in F theory or something, 11-dimensional. Sometimes people put two time directions anyway. But this one also, all of those would be invertible. However, that, of course, this means that there's some basis in which it's just all plus ones. This means there's some basis in which there's two plus ones and two minus ones. And however, if you got a basis like zero plus plus plus, no, zero plus plus, this is actually the signature on the horizon of a black hole, for example. So if you had a basis like this, then it means that there's some, I mean, if you have a signature like this, it means there's some basis in which the metric looks like this. Of course, that's not invertible. So basically, if there's a direction in the tangent space which whose inner product with every other vector is zero, then you get a zero in the signature. And that, of course, means that there's something in its kernel, the way I just described it. That means that it can't be invertible. What did I want to say? Yeah, what I haven't shown here is that the signature is well defined in the sense that how do you know that it can't happen that there's a basis in which it looks like this and there's some other basis in which they're all plus signs or something like that. That, in fact, cannot happen. But we haven't needed that for what I just said. As long as there is some basis in which it looks like this, then it will be invertible. Yeah.
The signature can just be read off from the eigenvalue.
In fact, they are the signs of the eigenvalues, but that's actually not the best way of thinking of it. What you really want is an orthonormal basis. See, to diagonalize a metric, to diagonalize a matrix, what are you doing? You're solving an equation. Suppose you have some matrix, M, A, B, and this is written with malice aforethought. In other words, I was very careful to put the indices in this way, and now I want to solve an eigenvalue equation. That equation makes perfect sense. The indices match up. And so a tensor like this does have eigenvalues. However, the metric tensor is covariant. If I try and write an equation like this, this is where the notation, since it's a good notation, helps you to think correctly. If I tried to write this lambda times VA, you see that it doesn't make sense because the indices don't. The left-hand side is a covariant vector. Well, this makes sense, but it's undefined. What doesn't make sense is this. So the right-hand side is a contravariant vector and the left-hand side is a covariant vector. So I can't really write. So there's really no notion of eigenvalue of a metric. But what there is a notion of is an orthonormal basis. So maybe that's a good lead-in to what I was about to say, which was to talk about orthonormal bases. So the best way to find a signature of some covariant symmetric tensor like this is to find an orthonormal basis for it. And that's actually something much easier than finding the eigenvalues, right? If you think how to write a computer program to diagonalize a matrix, it's an endless process. You just get better and better approximations to it. You never get the exact eigenvalues. It has to be done. Yeah, I mean, There's no sort of simple closed form formula, but no sort of effective procedure for getting the eigenvalues and eigenvectors. But to get the orthonormal basis, that's a very simple few-step process, which is called Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization, which you've probably seen before. And so, so for practical reasons, it's much better to think about the signature as coming from that than coming from eigenvalues. But it is true, I won't try and prove it here, but it is true that if you just took some basis, expressed the tensor as a matrix, and did diagonalize it, which I said is not, in some sense, a sensible thing to do. But if you did it, you'd still get some numbers, and they would have signs. And if you just looked at those signs, they would give you the signature. The numbers themselves would be meaningless, but the collection of signs that you got would be equivalent to the signature. Okay, so now, having talked about orthonormal bases, let me define them. Of course, you know what it means. It just means, ortho means all the basis elements are orthogonal to each other, and normal means they're all normalized. So it's just a basis which has the property that EA, EB, contracted using the metric tensor, is the diagonal, which is this one that we just wrote before, usually called A to AB. So that's an ortho. Of course, we couldn't put all plus signs here. That's the point. That's what we were just talking about. But we could have one minus and the rest plus. That's called an orthonormal basis. And all other similar equations that you can write, that all the equations that the rules of the indices allow you to write, are basically true. The main other one being this completeness relation, which is, why have I written it like this? Well, let's write it like this. Eta alpha beta E alpha A E beta B, right? So that's also true. You can just play around and see that this is equivalent to this. But if we expand this out, it's answering a question that someone asked a while ago. So now I'll just expand out what these indices actually are using. That eta is diagonal. It's E0 A, E0 B plus E1 E1 AB plus E2 E2 AB plus, I won't write the last term out in detail, but so what this is telling you, now that we have an orthonormal basis, is that the metric, this is explicitly exhibiting the metric tensor, as a sum of tensor products of covectors, namely the sort of time-like unit vector, covector, and the space-like unit vectors. And of course, this one comes with a minus sign. So again, one sees the signature here, one minus sign and three plus signs. Oh, I know what I wanted to say. If, when we were talking about these more general signatures, I guess they're here. Yeah, here they are. In that case, of course, we couldn't really have an orthonormal basis because you can't normalize a vector that has zero length. But what you would have in that case would be an orthogonal basis. So you could, those which are of finite length, you could normalize them to have unit length, plus or minus one, dotting when you dot them into themselves. The one which have zero length, you couldn't normalize, but it would still be an orthogonal basis, and it would, and they would, in any case, drop out of this sum precisely because they have zero length. So there'd always be this sort of canonical way of writing any symmetric tensor in terms of these quote-unquote ortho quote unquote normal basis. Or, I mean, the point is, if it's not invertible, then this won't be a basis. Some of these terms will be zero. So, but it'll still, there'll still be, there still will be a basis, which is orthogonal. Just that some of the terms will drop out. So now here's a warning. This is all very nice, but we've just seen two different types of bases. We saw the coordinate bases, and now we've seen orthonormal bases. So given a space-time, there's nothing to stop you from choosing coordinates and getting coordinate bases. There's also nothing to stop you from choosing at each, for each tangent space, for each point, choosing an orthonormal basis. And that's also done very commonly. It's called the Cartan formalism or something like that. And I think some of you have actually seen it in the, just now, I think Bruce Gregory was just doing it in the Psi lectures. Is that right? Does anyone know? I thought we had. Was there some, maybe no one here was attending the Psi lectures? How about last year? I think she probably did the same thing last year. Did she? Did Ruth do that? I think so. Well, anyway, I'm not sure. Anyway, but it's a very common tool that people use. It may be that it was too long ago and went by too fast to remember exactly what she had done. But there's two kinds of bases that are very convenient to use. Orthonormal bases are very convenient for obvious reasons, because it makes everything at a tangent space look like special relativity. But what you lose is, for example, this equation. Then the covectors of the basis are not the gradient of any functions anymore. And the other thing that's convenient is the coordinate basis. So the only warning here is that the coordinate basis is not, in general, an orthonormal basis. In general, in Minkowski space, you get both in a flat space. But in a general curved space, you really can't have both. And you don't have to have either, but it's usually convenient to have one or the other. And both are used. The language that's used just for this sometimes is that these are what's called anholonomic. Don't ask me exactly what holonomic means. If you remember classical mechanics, there's probably some explanation of what it is. What is it? You know what?
I was just
going to ask you. Oh, yeah, but you raised your hand after I said. Yeah, don't ask me. But it has something to do with the fact that you can't write the basis covector as the gradient of a function. So what it means is that the sort of the curl or the exterior derivative of the cobasis vector field is not zero. Anyway, sometimes the word anholonomic is used to indicate that it's not a coordinate basis. Okay, last topic, tensors and dimensions, dimensional analysis. This is always one of the most confusing things, especially because you can choose. I mean, there's a lot of conventions that you make. You can use different conventions, and then the same object will look to have different kind of units or different kinds of dimension. But so I'll show you one, which is, I think, as useful as any of the others, which is the following. So the question is, how do we assign dimensions to these objects? Well, so what does it mean to have a dimension of a length, for example? Well, one way of thinking about it, probably the way it's introduced to you, is that it's something whose value changes, rescales when you change your unit of measurement of length. Okay, it's just that you're comparing it to some sort of thing that's physically a length. If we think like that, the manifold itself consists of points that don't have anything to do with measurement of length, there's no reason that they change. You wouldn't even know where to send them. I mean, suppose you had a sphere, for example, two points in a sphere, and you changed your measurement of, you can't rescale it. You could change the whole sphere size. That's a different story. That's something to do with the metric. But these points wouldn't go anywhere necessarily. So again, flat space is a little misleading because you can think of rescaling, you know, a scale transformation or a homotopy sometimes it's called. Something just changed. But in a general manifold, it makes no sense. So you shouldn't think of the points themselves as having a dimension. You should think of them dimensionable. They're dimensionless. Therefore, you should think of vectors, which are just sort of infinitesimal displacements. We should think of them as not having dimension either, not changing under rescaling. So that's the first convention that I'm going to make. Okay, so that's invariant, so to speak. It doesn't change when we change our unit of length. On the other hand, we know that the length of something better change when we change our unit of length. I mean, a length should be a length. This is a length squared. We've said that this is dimensionless, which I'll probably write by saying that I'll use this notation, meaning to mean that it's dimensionless. This, of course, has to be a length squared. So I'll use L for the unit, you know, something that's a length. So this is a length squared, but this is dimensionless. That implies that the metric AB is also a length squared. And this thing is the basis of most of the dimensional analysis. So you may think that it's strange to give the metric a dimension. We'll see in a minute that there's something called engineering dimensions where the components of the metric will be dimensionless. But the metric itself as a tensor field has got dimensions. It won't seem so strange to you if you know about something called conformal weight, how something changes under the conformal change of the metric, then the metric does not have zero conformal weight. It changes when you conformally change the metric, obviously. Also, this Kronecker delta, obviously, that's clearly dimensionless, because it's just the identity map of some dimensionless thing into itself. And since the inverse metric is defined by that equation here, if this is dimensionless and this has dimensions length squared, then the inverse metric must have dimensions length to the minus 2, right? Now, what about components? I mean, this tells you at least the dimensions of the metric. It doesn't tell you the dimensions of everything. Of course, everything is a lot of things, and so many things have dimensions for other reasons, like the stress energy tensor and so on. But at least for the geometrical things, this gives you their dimensions. But now what about their components? Well, the components, remember, we get the components by contracting. The components of a tensor we get by contracting with basis vectors or covectors. So it boils down to the question, what are the dimensions of the basis vectors and covectors? What do I want? So consider this object. What's this? Now I'm going to be a little, so far I've been setting C equal 1, but now I'm going to now allow C not to equal 1, just because sometimes that's useful, like in taking the Newtonian limit, as we saw before. So I'm going to distinguish time from length for just a little bit. So I claim that the zeros, if we use a sort of Cartesian set of bases, like an orthonormal basis, then, or even if we don't, but we call some directions time-like and some space-like, then I claim that the zeros basis vector should have the units of a time, or rather an inverse time. The spatial vectors, basis vectors, should have the units of an inverse length, and when I go to the dual basis, it's the other way around. The dual basis vector and so on, the zeroth one, the basis covector that's time-like should have the units of a time, and the covector that's space-like should have the units of length. So k, of course, k equals 1, 2, 3 here. So why do I say this? Well, there's, you can look at it in different ways, all fortunately leading to the same conclusion. First, remember, so here's the first proof, if you like. Remember the formula that we had where E alpha was equal to the gradient, E alpha A was equal to the gradient of this X alpha. In the case of zero, that means E zero, the zeroth basis vector, covector, sorry, should be the gradient of T, which we usually call X zero T, the gradient of the time. The gradient doesn't have any dimensions anymore, if you think it through, than V does. The gradient operator itself does not have dimensions. Or I'll claim that that's a natural choice. If we make that choice, then this covector just inherits its dimensions from the T coordinate, which normally we would give dimensions of T, of time. So that leads to these results, this conclusion. Another argument, so this is under the assumption that the gradient, that this has dimension 1. So gradient has dimension 1. In other words, the gradient of some field has the same dimensions as the field it does. Another argument may be more convincing, I'm not sure. But anyway, they're just different motivations for this choice, and they both lead to the same conclusion, is let's look at what's an orthonormal basis. We'd like, for example, to allow this to be an orthonormal basis. Suppose it is an orthonormal basis, then GAB EA alpha EB beta, let me take a special case, say 3, because I'm here distinguishing space from time. So let's just look at one example. This we know, let me not do it yet. We know that this is equal to eta alpha beta by definition, but that was, again, minus 1, 1, 1. Those are just numbers, so they're dimensionless. So these components of eta alpha beta, they're dimensionless. So this had dimension of length squared, or if I try to distinguish space length from time, then it has an inhomogeneous set of dimensions. But if I don't bother with that for the second, then this has dimensions of length squared. So each of these must have dimension of inverse length, which is what I wrote up here. It leads to the same conclusion. If you want to be more careful about distinguishing space directions from time directions, then you'd have to say that this is has different dimensions in different directions, so to speak. And then you'll get that more refined classification that I wrote there. The last comment is, but why does this look so different from what I'm used to? Normally I'm used to thinking that vectors, if they're displacement vectors, they're lengths, and the metric is dimensionless because you're used to writing this down. Well, we saw that the components of the, although the metric isn't dimensionless, its components are, and that's true in general. So what's called the engineering dimensions sometimes of a tensor actually turn out, aside from factors of c, the speed of light, they turn out to be independent of where you put the indices. Oh yeah, I didn't stress this point. But because we gave this in dimensions of length squared and we gave this dimensions of inverse length, that means when you raise and lower indices, you'll change the dimensions of the tensor. This being an example, this is the same tensor but with raised or lowered indices, has different dimensions. That's also kind of awkward. If we look at the so-called engineering dimensions, which are the dimensions of the components, then this doesn't happen, as I said, aside from factors of C. So let's take an example. So these are the dimensions of the components. So let's just take one example. So take a vector that's just a geometrical tangent vector, so it's dimensionless. Of course, other vectors, like momentum vectors, can have different dimensions. Let's think of this as a displacement vector. Then we just saw that this is an A, I didn't write it very clearly. That's the vector itself. But now if we take its component, V0, that's equal, I don't need the parentheses since I wrote a 0. E0 is equal to the 0 basis vector, which I don't need the parentheses, but wrote them. It contracted with this, right? And that goes like, in this case, we saw that the dimensions of this time-like co-basis vector is time. And we saw that we've assumed that the dimensions of V is 1, so we get a time. So the dimensions of the zeroth component, the time-like component of a displacement vector is a time, which is maybe more what you're used to. And similarly, if I took V2, I'll just put the parentheses to show I'm not squaring something. If I just took V2, it would, and worked out its dimensions, you would find that it's a length. So its component in the spatial coordinate or basis direction is a length, its component in the temporal direction is a time. If we set C equal to 1 again, then all these components, no matter what direction, they're just all lengths. And now if we lower, the nice thing is now if we lower, if we use the lowered form, we get the same thing, because when you lower components, you lower it with the eta tensor, or with the components as a metric, which in an orthonormal basis is the eta tensor. Or more generally, what I'm saying is that the components of the metric, they are dimensionless, because we get them by contracting G, which has dimensions, with the basis vector, wherever they were. I guess I didn't. So the basis vectors, when C is 1, they just are all inverse lengths. So I contract the G, which has length squared dimension, with two basis vectors, which are inverse lengths, and again I get 1. So that's the sort of connection between these sort of tensor dimensions, which are like conformal weights, and these engineering dimensions, which are the ones that you're probably more used to seeing. So that's that fact that they're not the same, and the fact that these conformal weight type dimensions, these tensor ones, change when you raise and lower indices, that just adds to the confusion, but that's how it is. So you might ask how to convert the tensorial dimension, we just saw a special case, to the engineering dimension. But actually, if you study conformal field theory, it's another thing that I know you saw lectures on sometime last year, maybe. If you study conformal theory, then these things become useful, very relevant, these other kind of dimensions. So the tensorial dimension, if you want to convert it into the engineering dimension, you just take, or the component dimension, I could call it. You just take the dimension you started with, and you throw in a factor of t for each index of the form 0 that's upstairs, t inverse for each index of the form downstairs that's a 0, l for each index of the form k that's upstairs, and l inverse for each index of the form k, spatial index, that's downstairs. We probably won't, fortunately, have to deal with this dimensional analysis too much, but that's a set of rules that works. And then the last, almost finished. Last thing is, just one last example of the abstract index notation that may look a little strange to you. So this is in Minkowski space. So I'm going to write out, I already wrote out this formula in general and in terms of an orthonormal basis here, writing out the metric tensor as a tensor, as a sum of tensor products of covectors. Here's a special case in Minkowski space. It's not that there's anything very enlightening about this formula, but it just gives you practice in using the notation that we've adopted. Right. This is just that same formula, only it's written out. But I've written out what the basis vectors, covectors are as the gradients of the functions. If you wanted instead spherical coordinates, you could write. Now we would have partial A, partial B, R, and then we'd have. R squared, partial A theta, partial B theta, plus some other term, last term involving. So those are all true formulas. They're all equations that relate two tensors to each other. So I guess that's about where we have to stop. But let me make one important announcement. Maybe it's not that important, but it's important that I've tried to be very careful. I think, hopefully, I succeeded more or less in distinguishing things that will stop. Now we'll start. It becomes too painful to keep distinguishing them. So we've been distinguishing points in the manifold, coordinate functions, which are maps of the manifold into R4, and coordinate values of these functions, which are basically elements of R4, right? These are just sets of four numbers. These are four functions mapping the manifold into. So I tried to keep them all distinct. Here alpha equals 0, 1, 2, 3. But usually now, when this is what most people do, and I do also, we just collapse all these things. We just call a point of the manifold X. We don't bother to call it P. And if we're talking about the coordinate functions, we just write X alpha without bothering to distinguish whether it's the function X, which I've been writing as uppercase, or the value of the function, which is the point of R4, which I've been calling little x. So I use the same X for the function and for its value, and we'll use also the same x, only without the index, for a point of the manifold. And hopefully it won't lead to any confusion. So this is the new sloppier, but much more convenient notation. So if you want to go back and prove, you know, that vector addition is well-defined or something, then it's useful to keep these things straight, but once you've got the machinery all built up, then it's just more of a nuisance than anything else. Okay, so the next thing, which I hope to get a little bit into today, but we didn't, is the covariant derivative and parallel transport. So, any questions before we break? See you Thursday. Yeah.